life, from everything but her own feelings. The afternoon at the meadow replayed in her thoughts, particularly the ride on the shack, when Anakin had taken her back to the lodge. For the minutes of that ride, Padme had not hidden behind a mask of denial or behind anything else. Sitting behind Anakin, her arms about his waist, her head resting on the back of his shoulder, she had felt safe and secure, perfectly content, and she had to take a deep breath to keep her hand from trembling as she reached up for the doorknob. She pulled the door back and could see nothing but the tall and lean silhouette, backlit by the setting sun. Anakin shifted just a bit, blocking the rosy glow enough so that Padme could see his smile. He started to move in, but she held her ground. It wasn't a conscious decision. She was simply entranced, for it seemed to her as if the sun was setting behind Anakin's shoulders and not behind the horizon, as if he was big enough to dismiss the day. Orange flames danced about his silhouette, dulling the distinction between Anakin and eternity. Padme had to consciously remember to breathe. She stepped back, and Anakin sauntered in, apparently oblivious to the wondrous moment she had just experienced. He was grinning mischievously, and for some reason she felt embarrassed. She wondered for a moment if she should have chosen a different outfit, for the evening dress she was wearing was black and off the shoulder, showing quite a bit of flesh. She wore a black choker as well, with a line of sheer fabric running down over the front of the dress, barely concealing her cleavage. She moved to close the door, but paused and looked back over the lake, at the rose-colored tint filtering across the shimmering water. When she turned back, Anakin was already standing by the table, looking over the bowl of fruit and the settings Padme had put out. She watched him glance up at one of the floating light globes, its glow growing as the sunlight began to diminish outside. He playfully poked at it, seeming oblivious that she or anyone else was watching him, and his smile nearly reached his ears as the globe bounced away from his touch, elongating the soft sphere of light. The next few moments of just watching Anakin were quite pleasant for Padme, but the next few after that, when he started looking back at her, his expression, alternately playful and intense, proved more than a bit uncomfortable. Soon enough, though, the pair had settled in at the table, seated across from each other. Two of the resort waitresses, Nandi and Tekla, served them their meal, while Anakin began recounting some of the adventures he had known over the last 10 years, training and flying with Obi-Wan. Padme listened attentively, captivated by Anakin's flair for storytelling. She wanted to do more, though. She wanted to talk about what had happened out at the meadow, to try to make some sense of it with Anakin, to share with him the solution as they had shared the out-of-bounds emotions and moments. But she could not begin, and so she just allowed him to ramble on, contenting herself with enjoying his tales. Dessert was Padme's favorite, yellow and cream-colored shura fruit, juicy and sweet. She grinned as Nandi put a bowl before her. "And when I went to them, we went into..." Anakin paused, drawing Padme's full attention, a wry smile on his face. "Aggressive negotiations," he finished. And then he thanked Tekla as she placed some dessert fruit before him. "Aggressive negotiations? What's that?" "Ah, well, negotiations with a lightsaber," the Padawan said, still grinning wryly. "Oh," Padme said with a laugh, and she eagerly went for her dessert, stabbing with her fork. The shura moved, and her fork hit the plate. A bit confused, Padme stabbed at it again. It moved. She looked up at Anakin, a bit confused and embarrassed. But then she saw that he was fighting hard not to laugh, staring down at his own plate a bit too innocently. "You did that!" He looked up, his expression wide-eyed. "What?" Padme scowled, pointing her fork at him and waving it threateningly. Then suddenly she went for the shura again. But Anakin was quicker. The fruit slipped out of the way, and she stabbed the plate. Then, before she could scowl at him again, the shura rose into the air to hover before her. "That," Padme answered. "Now stop it!" She couldn't hold her feigned anger, though, and laughed aloud as she finished. Anakin started laughing, too. Half looking at him, Padme snapped her hand at the floating fruit. He waggled his fingers, and the fruit looped about her hand. Anakin! If Master Obi-Wan was here, he'd be very grumpy, the Padawan admitted. He pulled back his hand, and the Shura flew across the table to his waiting grasp. But he's not here, he added, cutting the fruit into several slices. Reaching for the Force, he made one piece float upward and slide toward Padme. She bit it right out of the air. Padme laughed, and so did Anakin. They finished the dessert with many fleeting glances. And then, as Teclan Nandi returned to clean up the plates, the couple retreated to the sitting area, with its comfortable chairs and sofa, and a huge warm fire blazing in the hearth. Nandi and Tekla finished and bade the couple goodbye. And then they were alone. Completely alone. And the tension returned almost immediately. She wanted him to kiss her so desperately, and it was precisely that out-of-control sensation that had stopped her cold. This was not right. She knew that in her head, despite what her heart might be telling her. They each had bigger responsibilities for the time being. She had to deal with the continuing split of the Republic, and he had to continue his Jedi training. Anakin settled back, frustration evident on his boyish features. From the moment I met you, all those years ago, a day hasn't gone by when I haven't thought of you. His voice was husky, intense, and the sparkle in his eyes bored right through her. And now that I'm with you again, I'm in agony. The closer I get to you, the worse it gets. The thought of not being with you makes my stomach turn over, my mouth go dry. I feel dizzy. I can't breathe. I'm haunted by the kiss you never should have given me. My heart is beating, hoping that kiss will not become a scar. Padme's hand slowly dropped to her side, and she sat listening in amazement at how honestly he was opening up before her, baring his heart, though he knew she might tear it asunder with a single word. She was honored by the thought, and truly touched, and afraid. You are in my very soul, tormenting me, Anakin went on, not a bit of falseness in his tone. This was no ploy to garner any physical favors. This was honest and straightforward, refreshingly so to the woman who had spent most of her life being attended by handmaidens, whose job it was to please, and entertaining dignitaries, whose agendas were never quite what they seemed. What can I do? He asked softly. I will do anything you ask. Padme looked away, overwhelmed, finding security in the distracting dance of the flames in the hearth. Several moments of silence slipped by uncomfortably. If you are suffering as much as I am, tell me, Anakin prompted. Padme turned on him, her own frustrations bubbling over. I can't. She sat back and struggled to collect herself. We can't, she said as calmly as she could. It's just not possible. Anything's possible, Anakin replied, leaning forward. Padme, please, listen. You listen, she scolded. Somehow, hearing her own denial brought some strength to her. Much-needed strength. We live in a real world. Come back to it, Anakin. You're studying to become a Jedi Knight. I'm a senator. If you follow your thoughts through to conclusion, they will take us to a place we cannot go. Regardless of the way we feel about each other. Then you do feel something. Padme swallowed hard. Jedi aren't allowed to marry, she pointed out, needing to deflect attention away from her feelings at that debilitating moment. You'd be expelled from the Order. I will not let you give up your future for me. You're asking me to be rational, Anakin replied without the slightest hesitation. And his confidence and boldness here caught Padme a bit by surprise. There was no longer anything of the child in the man before her. She felt her control slip a notch. That is something I know I cannot do, he went on. Believe me, I wish I could wish my feelings away, but I can't. I am not going to give in to this, she said with all the conviction she could muster. She finished with her jaw clenched very tightly. Knowing that she had to be the strong one here, for Anakin's sake, more than for her own. I have more important things to do than fall in love. He turned away, looking wounded, and she winced. He stared into the fire, his face twisting this way and that as he tried to sort through it all. She knew he was trying to find a way around her resolve. It wouldn't have to be that way, he said at length. We could keep it a secret. Then we'd be living a lie, one we couldn't keep up even if we wanted to. My sister saw it, so did my mother. I couldn't do that. Could you, Anakin? Could you live like that? He stared at her intensely for a moment, then looked back to the fire, seeming defeated. No, you're right, he finally admitted. It would destroy us. Padme looked from Anakin to the fire. Which would destroy her? Destroy them, she had to wonder. The action or the thought? Chapter 16. Wow! Boba Fett exclaimed, rushing across the landing pad to view the sleek starfighter up close. Beautiful ship, Jango agreed, strolling to catch up to his son, studying the craft with every stride. He noted the markings and design, the extra firepower, and particularly, the astromech droid hardwired into the left wing, tootling happily. This is a Delta 7, the excited Boba announced, pointing out the rear cockpit position. Jango nodded, glad that his son had been taking his lessons seriously. These were new ships, so new that they hadn't yet been fitted with hyperdrive engines, Jango realized, and he inadvertently glanced up at the cloudy sky, wondering if parent ships were up there. He shook the thought away, turning back to Boba. And what of the droid? He asked. Can you identify the unit? Boba climbed up the side of the fighter and studied the markings for a moment, then turned back to his father, finger to pursed lips, an intense expression on his face. It's an R4P, he said. And is that a common droid for this type of starfighter? No, Boba answered without hesitation. A Delta 7 pilot would usually use an R3D. It's better at keeping the guns targeted, and the fighter is so maneuverable that handling the laser cannons is tricky. I read that some pilots wind up shooting their own nose cones off in this fighter. They do a snap roll, coming out over and around, but they haven't compensated the manual swivel. As he spoke, he moved his arms over each other and about, tangling them up in front of him. Jango was hardly listening to the details, though he was thrilled that Boba had taken to his lessons with such energy. Suppose the pilot didn't need the extra gunnery skills of an R3D, he asked. Boba looked at him curiously, as if he didn't understand. Would the R4P then be a better choice? Yes, came the halting response. And what pilot wouldn't need the extra droid gunnery skills? Boba stared blankly, but then a smile spread on his face. You, he blurted, seeming quite pleased with himself. Jango took the compliment with an appreciative smile, and it was true enough. Jango could wheel any fighter, and if he ever had the opportunity to fly in a Delta 7, he'd likely choose an R4P over the R3D. But that wasn't what he had in mind right now. For he knew of one other type of pilot, pilots with heightened senses, who would similarly choose the better nav, but less weapon-oriented droid. Jango Fett looked back up at the sky, wondering if a host of Jedi were about to descend upon Topoka City. Great racks holding glass spheres stretched across the immense room to the end of Obi-Wan's vision. Each sphere contained an embryo, suspended in fluid, and when the Jedi reached into the Force, he sensed strong waves of life energy. The hatchery, he stated more than asked. The first phase, obviously, Lamassu replied. Very impressive. I hoped you would be pleased, Master Jedi, the Prime Minister said. Clones can think creatively, you'll find that they are immensely superior to droids, and that ours are the best in all the galaxy. Our methods have been perfected over many centuries. How many are there? Obi-Wan asked. In here, I mean. We have several hatcheries throughout the city. This, of course, is the most crucial phase. Though with our techniques, we expect a survival rate of over 90%. Every so often, an entire batch will develop an issue. But we expect the clone production to remain steady. And with our accelerated growth methods, these before you will be fully matured and ready for battle in just over a decade. 200,000 units are ready, with another million well on the way. Lama Su's previous boast echoed ominously in Obi-Wan's thoughts. A production center, supremely efficient, producing a steady stream of superbly trained and conditioned warriors. The implications were staggering. Obi-Wan stared at the closest embryo, floating contentedly in its fluid, curled, and with its little thumb stuck into its mouth. In 10 short years, that tiny creature, that tiny man, would be a soldier, killing, and likely, soon enough, killed. He shuddered and looked to his Kaminoan guide. Come, Lama Su bade him, walking along the corridor. Next on the tour was a huge classroom with desks in neat, orderly rows, and with students in neat, orderly rows. They all looked to be about 10 years of age, all dressed the same, all with the same haircut, all with exactly the same features and posture and expressions. Obi-Wan reflexively looked at the shining white walls of the huge room, almost expecting to see mirrors there, playing a trick on his eyes, to make one boy seem to be many. The students went about their studies, without paying any more heed to the visitors than a quick glance. Disciplined, Obi-Wan thought. Much more so than any normal children. Another thought grabbed him. You mentioned growth acceleration. Oh, yes. It's essential, the Prime Minister replied. Otherwise, a mature clone would take a lifetime to grow. Now we can do it in half the time. The units you will soon see on the parade ground, we started 10 years ago, when Sifo Dyas first placed the order, and they're already mature and quite ready for duty. And these were started about 5 years ago? The Jedi reasoned, and Lama Su nodded. Would you care to inspect the final product now? The Prime Minister asked, and Obi-Wan could hear excitement in his voice. Clearly he was proud of this accomplishment. I would like your approval before you take delivery. The callousness of it all struck Obi-Wan profoundly. Units. Final product. These were living beings they were talking about. Living, breathing, and thinking. To create clones for such a singular purpose, under such control, even stealing half their childhood for efficiency, assaulted his sense of right and wrong. And the fact that a Jedi Master had begun all of this was almost too much to digest. The tour took him through the commissary next, where hundreds of adult clones, all young men Anakin's age, sat in neat rows, all dressed in black, all eating the same food in the same manner. You'll find that they are totally obedient, Lama Su was saying, seemingly oblivious to the Jedi's discomfort. We modified their genetic structure to make them less independent than the original, of course. Who was the original? A bounty hunter named Jango Fett, Lama Su offered without any hesitation. We felt that a Jedi would be the perfect choice, but Sifo Dyas handpicked Jango himself. The notion that a Jedi might have been used nearly floored Obi-Wan. An army of clones strong in the Force? Where is this bounty hunter now? He asked. He lives here, Lama Su replied. But he's free to come and go as he pleases. He kept walking as he spoke, leading Obi-Wan along a long corridor filled with narrow transparent tubes. The Jedi watched with amazement as clones climbed up into those tubes and settled in place, closing their eyes and going to sleep. "Very disciplined," he remarked.
"That is the key," Lamassu replied. "Disciplined, and yet with the ability to think creatively. It is a mighty combination. Sifo Dyas explained to us the Jedi aversion to leading droids. He told us Jedi could only command an army of life forms. And you wanted a Jedi as host," Obi-Wan thought, but he did not say it aloud.
He took a deep breath, wondering how Master Sifo Dyas, how any Jedi, could have so willingly and unilaterally crossed the line to create any army of clones. Obi-Wan realized that he had to suppress his need for a direct answer to that right now, and simply listen and observe, gather as much information as he could, so that he and the Jedi Council might sort it out. "So Jango Fett willingly remains on Kamino?"
"The choice is his alone. Apart from his pay, which is considerable, I assure you, Fett demanded only one thing. An unaltered clone for himself. Curious, isn't it?"
"Unaltered?"
"Pure genetic replication," the Prime Minister explained. "No tampering with the structure to make it more docile. And no growth acceleration."
"I would very much like to meet this Jango Fett," Obi-Wan said, as much to himself as to Lamassu. He was intrigued. Who was this man selected by Sifo Dyas as the perfect source for a clone army?
Lamassu looked at Ton Wee, who nodded and said, "I would be most happy to arrange it for you."
She left them then, as the tour continued, with Lamassu taking Obi-Wan along the areas that showed him pretty much the entire routine of the clones at every level of their development. The culmination came later on, when Ton Wee rejoined the pair in a balcony, sheltered from the brutal wind and rain, and overlooking a huge parade ground. Below them, thousands and thousands of clone troopers, dressed in white armor and wearing full face helmets, marched and drilled with all the precision of programmed droids. Entire formations, each made up of hundreds of soldiers, moved as one.
"Magnificent, aren't they?" Lamassu said.
Obi-Wan looked up at the Kaminoan to see his eyes glowing with pride as he looked out upon his creation. There were no ethical dilemmas as far as Lamassu was concerned, Obi-Wan knew immediately. Perhaps that was why the Kaminoans were so good at cloning. Their consciences never got in the way. Lamassu looked down at him, smiling widely, prompting a response, and Obi-Wan offered a silent nod.
"Yes, they were magnificent.
And the Jedi could only imagine the brutal efficiency this group would exhibit in battle, in the arena for which they were grown. Once again, neither for the first nor the last time that day, a shudder coursed down Obi-Wan Kenobi's spine. For the first time, he appreciated Senator Amidala's crusade to stop the creation of an army of the Republic, and the inevitable consequence, war. A Jedi Knight, here on Kamino. The thought was more than a little unsettling to Jango Fett. The bounty hunter fell back in his seat and tightened his face in frustration. Such were the problems with working for the Trade Federation. They were masters at weaving deception within deception, and they were up to so much right now that there was no single focus Jango could determine. He looked across the room at Boba, who was hard at work poring over the schematics and capabilities of a Delta VII starfighter, and matching them up against the known strengths and weaknesses of an R4P unit. Life was so simple for the boy, Jango thought, with a touch of envy. For Boba, there was the love of and for his father and his studies. Other than those two givens, the only real challenge before the boy was in finding enjoyable things to do at those times when Jango was away or busy with the Kaminoans. At that moment, looking at his son, Jango Fett felt vulnerable. so very vulnerable. And it was not an emotion with which he was the least bit comfortable. He almost told Boba to go and pack then and there, so they could blast away from Kamino. But he recognized the danger of that course. He would be leaving without learning anything about his potential enemy. This Jedi Knight, who had arrived unexpectedly. His boss would want that information. And Jango would need that information. If he took off now, after receiving a note from Tonwi telling him that he would be receiving a visitor later that same day, it would be fairly obvious that he was fleeing. Then he'd have a Jedi Knight on his tail, and one about whom he knew practically nothing. Jango continued to stare at Boba, at the only thing that really mattered. "Play it cool," he whispered to himself. "You're nothing more than a clone source. Well paid enough to want to know nothing about why you're being cloned." That was his litany. That was his plan. And it had to work. For Boba's sake. A wave of Tonwi's hand brought forth the chime of an unseen bell, reminding Obi-Wan yet again of how foreign this world of Kamino, this city of Tapoka, really was. He didn't give it much thought, though, for he was focused on the locking mechanism on the door before him. An elaborate electronic clasp and bolt. Quite a bit of security, it seemed to him, given the supposedly genteel nature of Jango Fett's relationship with the Kaminoans, and the obvious control the cloners held over their city. Was the locking mechanism designed to keep people out, or to keep Jango in? Likely the former, he reasoned. Jango was a bounty hunter, after all. Perhaps he had made more than a few dangerous enemies. He was still studying the device when the door suddenly opened, revealing a young boy, an exact replica of those Obi-Wan had been viewing all day. The identical one that Jango had demanded. Only this one was actually 10 years old.
"Boba," Tonwi said with great familiarity, "is your father home?"
Boba Fett stood, staring at the human visitor for a long moment.
"Yep."
"May we see him?"
"Sure," Boba answered. He stepped back, but his eyes never left Obi-Wan, as the Jedi and Tonwi stepped across the threshold.
"Dad!"
Boba yelled. The title struck Obi-Wan as curious, given that this was a clone and not a natural son. Was there a connection here? A real one. Had Jango wanted the exact replica not for any professional gain, but simply because he had wanted a son?
"Dad!" the boy shouted again. "Tonwi's here!"
Jango Fett walked in, dressed in simple shirt and trousers. Obi-Wan recognized him immediately, though he was many years older than the oldest clone, his face scarred and pitted and unshaven. His body had thickened with age, but he was still physically imposing, much like many of the old gutter dwellers Obi-Wan encountered in far-flung places. A few extra pounds, sure, but those covered muscles hardened by years of tough living. Tattoos crossed both of Jango's muscular forearms, of a strange design that Obi-Wan did not recognize. As he glanced up, he recognized the clear suspicion with which Jango was eyeing him. The man was on edge here. Dangerously so, Obi-Wan understood.
"Welcome back, Jango," Tonwi remarked. "Was your trip productive?"
Obi-Wan studied the bounty hunter intensely. Back from where? But Jango was a professional, and his expression revealed not the slightest tick or wince. "Fairly," the man casually offered. He continued to size up Obi-Wan as he spoke, his eyes narrowing in an almost open threat.
"This is Jedi Master Obi-Wan Kenobi," Tonwi said, her tone lighter, obviously an attempt to relieve some of the palpable tension. "He's come to check on our progress."
"That right." If Jango cared, his tone didn't show it.
"Your clones are very impressive," Obi-Wan said. "You must be very proud."
"I'm just a simple man trying to make my way in the universe, Master Jedi." "Aren't we all?"
Obi-Wan finally broke eye contact with Jango as he spoke, scanning the room, looking for clues. He focused on the half-open door through which Jango had appeared, and thought he saw pieces of body armor in there, battered and stained, much like that worn by a rocket man after delivering a toxic dart into the changeling Zam Wessel. And he saw a curving bluish line, like the goggle and breather area of the helmet he had seen back on Coruscant. Before he could scrutinize the sight any more closely, though, Jango walked in front of him, pointedly blocking his view.
"Ever make your way as far into the interior as Coruscant?" Obi-Wan asked, rather bluntly.
"Once or twice."
"Recently?"
Again, the bounty hunter's gaze became obviously suspicious.
"Possibly." "Then you must know Master Sifo Dyas," Obi-Wan remarked, not out of any logical follow-up reasoning, but simply to gauge the man's reaction.
There was none, nor did Jango Fett move a centimeter out of Obi-Wan's line of sight. And when the Jedi tried to subtly alter his angle to gain a view, Jango said, in a coded language,
"Boba, close the door."
Not until that bedroom door shut did Jango Fett move to the side, and then it seemed to Obi-Wan as if the man was stalking him.
"Master who?" Jango asked.
"Sifo Dyas. Isn't he the one who hired you for this job?"
"Never heard of him," Jango replied.
And if there was a lie in his words, Obi-Wan could not detect it.
"Really?"
"I was recruited by a man called Tyrannus on one of the moons of Bogdan," Jango explained.
And again it seemed to Obi-Wan as if he was speaking truthfully.
"Curious," Obi-Wan muttered.
He glanced down, surprised, and at a loss as to what all of this might mean.
"Do you like your army?" Jango Fett asked him.
"I look forward to seeing them in action," the Jedi replied.
Jango continued to stare at him. To try to see his intent behind his words, Obi-Wan knew. And then, as if it hardly mattered, the bounty hunter gave a toothy smile.
"They'll do their job well, I'll guarantee that."
"Like their source?"
Jango Fett continued to smile.
"Thanks for your time, Jango,"
Obi-Wan said against that uncompromising stare. Then he turned to Ton Wee and started for the door.
"Always a pleasure to meet a Jedi," came the reply.
It was heavy with double meaning, almost like a veiled threat. But Obi-Wan wasn't about to call him on it. Jango Fett was clearly a dangerous man, streetwise and cunning, and likely better than most with any weapon handy. Before he pushed things any further, Obi-Wan realized that he should relay all that he had learned thus far back to Coruscant and the Jedi Council. This discovery of a clone army was nothing short of amazing, and more than a little unsettling, and none of it made much sense. And was Jango the rocket man Obi-Wan had seen in Coruscant that night when Padme Amidala had been attacked? Obi-Wan's gut told him that Jango was. But how did that jibe with the man also being the host for a clone army supposedly commissioned by a former Jedi master? With Ton Wee beside him, the Jedi left the apartment, and the door slid closed behind him. Obi-Wan paused and focused his senses back, even reaching out with the Force. The door lock quietly secured.
"It was his starfighter, wasn't it, Dad?" Boba Fett asked. "He's a Jedi Knight, so he can use the R4P.
Jango gave his son an absent nod.
"I knew it," Boba squealed.
But then Jango abruptly stole the moment. Jango fixed Boba with a no-nonsense look that the young boy had learned well not to ignore.
"What is it, Dad?"
"Pack your things, we're leaving."
Boba started to reply, but,
"Now," the bounty hunter said,
and Boba practically tripped over himself, scrambling for his bedroom. Jango Fett shook his head. He didn't need this aggravation. Not at this time. Not for the first time, the bounty hunter questioned his decision to take the contract against Padme Amidala. He had been surprised when the Trade Federation had approached him with the offer. They had been adamant, explaining only that the death of the senator was critical to securing necessary allies, and they had made an offer too lucrative for Django to refuse, one that would set him and Boba up forever on a planet of their choosing. Little had Django known, though, that taking the contract on Senator Amidala would put him in the crosshairs of the Jedi Knights. He looked across the way to Boba. That was not a place he wanted to be at this time. Not at all. Chapter 17. Padme awoke suddenly, her senses immediately tuning into her surroundings. Something was wrong, she knew instinctively, and she jumped up, scrambling about out of fear that another of those centipede creatures was upon her. But her room was quiet, with nothing out of place. Something had awakened her, but not something in here.
"No!"
came a cry from the adjoining bedroom, where Anakin was sleeping.
"No! Mom! No, don't!"
Padme slipped out of bed and ran to the door, not even bothering to grab a robe, not even caring or noticing that she was wearing a small silken shift. At the door, she paused and listened. Hearing cries from within, followed by more jumbled yelling, she realized that there was no immediate danger, that this was another of Anakin's nightmares, like the one that had gripped him on the shuttle ride to Naboo. She opened the door and looked in on him. He was thrashing about on the bed, yelling, "Mom!" repeatedly. Unsure, Padme started in. But then Anakin calmed and rolled back over. The dream, the vision, apparently passed. Then Padme did become aware of her revealing dress. She moved back through the door, shutting it gently, then waited for a long while. When she heard no further screaming or tossing, she went back to her bed. She lay awake in the dark for a long, long while, thinking of Anakin, thinking that she wanted to be in there beside him, holding him, helping him through his troubled dreams. She tried to dismiss the notion. They had already covered this dangerous ground and had come to an understanding of what must be. And that agreement did not include her climbing into bed beside Anakin. The next morning, she found him on the east balcony of the lodge, overlooking the lake in the budding sunrise. He was standing by the balustrade, so deep in thought that he did not notice her approach. She moved up slowly, not wanting to disturb him, for as she neared, she realized that he was doing more than thinking here, that he was actually deep in meditation. Recognizing this as a private time for Anakin, she turned and started away, as quietly as she could.
"Don't go," Anakin said to her.
"I don't want to disturb you," she told him, surprised.
"Your presence is soothing."
Padme considered those words for a bit, taking pleasure in hearing them, then scolding herself for taking that pleasure. But still, as she stood there looking upon him, his face now serene, she couldn't deny the attraction. He seemed to her like a young hero, a budding Jedi, and she had no doubt that he would be among the greatest that great order had ever known. And at the same time, he seemed to her to be the same little kid she had known during the war with the Trade Federation, inquisitive and impetuous, aggravating and charming all at once. "You had a nightmare again last night," she said quietly, when Anakin at last opened his blue eyes.
"Jedi don't have nightmares," came the defiant reply.
"I heard you," Padme was quick to answer. Anakin turned to regard her. There was no compromise in her expression. She knew perfectly well that his claim was ludicrous, and she let him know that she knew it.
"I saw my mother," he admitted, lowering his gaze. "I saw her as clearly as I see you now. She is suffering, Padme. They're killing her. She's in pain."
"Who?" Padme asked, moving toward him, putting a hand on his shoulder. When she looked at him more closely, she noted a determination so solid that it took her by surprise.
"I know I'm disobeying my mandate to protect you," Anakin tried to explain. "I know I'll be punished and possibly thrown out of the Jedi Order, but I have to go."
"Go?"
"I have to help her."
"I'm sorry, Padme," he said. She saw from his expression that he meant it.
that leaving her was the last thing he ever wanted to do.
I don't have a choice.
Of course you don't. Not if you believe that your mother is in trouble. Anakin gave her an appreciative nod.
I'll go with you, she decided.
Anakin's eyes widened. He started to reply, ready to argue, but Padme's smile held his words in check.
That way, you can continue to protect me, she reasoned.
Somehow she made it sound perfectly logical. And you won't be disobeying your mandate.
I don't think this is what the Jedi Council had in mind. I fear that I'm walking into danger, and to take you with me.
Walking into danger, Padme echoed, and she laughed aloud. A place I've never been before. Anakin stared at her, hardly believing what he was hearing. He couldn't resist, though, and his smile, too, began to widen. For some reason he did not quite understand, the Padawan found a good measure of justification in his abandoning the letter of his orders now that Padme was in on, and agreeing with, the plan. Neither Padme nor Anakin could miss the stark contrast when they took her sleek starship out of hyperspace and saw the brown planet of Tatooine looming before them. How different it was from Naboo, a place of green grasses and deep blue water, with cloud patterns swirling all across it. Tatooine was just a ball of brown, hanging in space, as barren as Naboo was alive. Home again to go to rest, Anakin recited, a common children's rhyme. By hearth and heart, house and nest, Padme added. Anakin looked over at her, pleasantly surprised.
You know it.
Doesn't everyone?
I don't know, Anakin said. I mean, I wasn't sure if anyone else. I thought it was a rhyme my mother made up for me.
Oh, I'm sorry, Padme said. Maybe she did. Maybe hers was different than the one my mother used to tell me. Anakin shook his head doubtfully, but he wasn't bothered by the possibility. In a strange way, he was glad that Padme knew the rhyme, glad that it was a common gift from mothers to their children, and glad especially that he and Padme had yet another thing in common. They haven't signaled any coordinates yet, she noted.
They probably won't unless we ask, Anakin replied. Things aren't very strict here, usually. Just find a place and park it, then hope no one steals it while you go about your business.
As lovely as I remember it. Anakin looked at her and nodded. How different things were now than that decade before when Padme had been forced to land on Tatooine with Obi-Wan and Qui-Gon in order to effect repairs on their ship. He tried to manage a smile, but the edge of his nervousness kept it from appearing genuine. Too many disturbing thoughts assaulted him. Was his mother all right? Was his dream a premonition of what was to come, or a replay of something that had already happened? He brought the ship down fast, breaking through the atmosphere and soaring across the sky. Mos Espa, he explained, when the skyscape of the city came into sight against the horizon. He went in hard, and some protests did squeal over the comlink. But Anakin knew his way around this place as surely as if he had never left. He did a flyby over the edge of the city, then put the starship down in a large landing bay amid a jumble of vessels of all merchant and mercenary classes.
Yous can't just drop in uninvited,
barked the dock officer, a stout creature with a piggish face and spikes running down the length of his back and tail. It's a good thing you invited us then, Anakin said calmly, with a slight wave of his hand.
Yes, it's a good thing I invited you then, the officer happily replied.
And Anakin and Padme walked past, with Padme giggling.
Anakin, you're bad, Padme said as they exited onto the dusty street.
It's not like there are dozens of ships lined up to fill the bay, Anakin replied, feeling pretty good about himself and the ease with which he had force-convinced the piggish officer. He waved down a floating rickshaw pulled by an ESPSA droid, a short and thin creature with a wheel where its leg should have been. Anakin gave it the address and off it went, pulling them behind in the floating rickshaw, charging along the streets of Mos Espa, expertly zigging and zagging to avoid the heavy traffic, and blasting forth a shrill sound whenever someone didn't get out of the way.
"Do you think he was involved?" Padme asked Anakin.
"Watto?"
"Yes, that was his name, right, your former master?"
"If Watto has hurt my mother in any way, I will pluck his wings from his back," he promised, meaning every word.
He wasn't sure how he would feel about seeing the slaver, even if Watto had nothing to do with bringing any harm to Shmi.
Watto had treated him better than most in Mos Espa treated their slaves, and hadn't beaten him too often.
But still, it hung in Anakin's thoughts that Watto had not let Shmi go with him when Obi-Wan and Qui-Gon had bought out his slave debt.
Anakin understood that he was probably just deflecting some of his own guilt about leaving his mother with Watto, who was a businessman after all.
"Here, Espasa," Anakin said to the droid, and the rickshaw glided to a stop in front of a shop, all too familiar to Anakin Skywalker. There, sitting on a stool near the door, fiddling with an electronic driver on a broken piece of equipment that looked like a droid component, was a rounded, winged Toydarian with a long snout. A black round hat adorned his head, and a small vest was pulled as far as it would go about his girth. Anakin recognized him immediately. He paused for so long in just staring at Watto that Padme got out before him and held her hand to help him.
"Wait here," she instructed the droid. "Please."
"Not Chuba the Wanga, the Wanga!"
Watto yelled at the broken component, and at a trio of pit droids who were scrambling all about trying to help.
"Hatties," Anakin explained to Padme.
"No, not that one, that one," she replied.
And at Anakin's expression of surprise that she knew the strange language, she added, "You think it's easy being the queen?"
Anakin shook his head and looked back to Watto, then glanced at Padme once or twice as they neared.
"Chut chut, Watto," he greeted.
"Kibuda,"
came the surprised response.
"Denova, chut chut," Anakin reiterated, his words barely audible above the clamoring pit droids.
"Go, Anabopa!"
Watto yelled at the trio. And on his command, they immediately shut down and snapped back into their storage position.
"Ding me chasahopa," Anakin offered, taking the piece of the broken droid from Watto and manipulating it expertly.
Watto watched him for a moment, his bug-like eyes growing even larger in surprise.
"Kibuda,"
he asked.
"You're ban pihota. No winga mi condorta. Kinchasa to Jedi. No batatutu."
"He doesn't know you," Padme whispered to Anakin, trying to hold back her laughter at Watto's last statement, which translated to, "Whatever it is, I didn't do it."
"Mi Bosca di Shmi Skywalker," Anakin bluntly stated.
Watto's eyes narrowed suspiciously. Who would be looking for his old slave? The Toydarian's gaze went from Anakin to Padme, then back to Anakin.
"Annie?"
he asked in basic.
"Little Annie? Nah."
Anakin's answer came with a deft twist of his hands, and the sound of the little piece of equipment whirring to life. Smiling widely, he handed it back to Watto. There weren't many around who could work such magic on broken droid parts.
"You are Annie!"
the Toydarian cried.
"It is you!"
His wings started beating furiously, lifting him from the stool to hover in the air.
"You sure sprouted!"
"Hello, Watto."
"Yo!"
the Toydarian cried.
"A Jedi! What do you know? Hey, maybe you could help me with some deadbeats who owe me a little money."
"My mother," Anakin prompted.
"Ah, yeah, Shmi. She's not mine no more. I sold her."
"Sold her?" Anakin felt Padme squeeze his forearm.
"Years ago. Sorry, Annie, but you know, business is a business. Sold it to a moisture farmer named Lars. At least I think it was Lars. Believe it or not, I heard he freed her and married her. Can you beat that?"
Anakin just shook his head, trying hard to digest it all.
"Do you know where they are?"
"Long way from here. Someplace over on the other side of Mos Eisley, I think."
"Could you narrow it down?" Watto thought about it for a moment, then just shrugged. I'd like to know, Anakin said, his tone and expression grim and determined, even threatening. The way Watto's features seemed to tighten showed that he got the hint that Anakin wasn't fooling around.
Yeah, sure, he said. Absolutely. Let's go look at my records.
The three went into the shop, and seeing the place brought memories swirling back to Anakin. How many hours, years he had toiled in here, fixing everything Watto threw his way. And out back, where he had put all the spare parts he could find so that he could build a pod racer. Not all of the memories were bad, he had to admit, but the good ones did not overcome the reality that he had been a slave. Watto's slave. Fortunately for Watto, his records gave a location for the moisture farm of one Cleeg Lars.
Stay a while, Annie,
the Toydarian offered after sharing the information on Shmi's new owner. Or was it her husband? Without a word, Anakin turned about and walked away. This was the last time he would look at Watto and the shop, he decided. Unless, of course, he found out that Watto was lying to him about Shmi's fate, or that Watto had somehow hurt his mother. Back to the lot, Espasa, he said to the droid, as he and Padme rushed back to the rickshaw. Fast!
Hey, you sure I can get you something to drink?
Watto called to them from the door of his shop. But they were already rushing away, kicking up dust in their wake.
Annie the Jedi,
Watto remarked, and he waved both his hands dismissively at the departing rickshaw.
Why do you know?
Anakin took the starship out even more furiously than he had brought it in, blasting away from the lot and nearly colliding with a small freighter as it maneuvered to put down. Calls of protest came into him from Mos Espa control, but he just switched off the comm and zoomed off across the city. Soon after, they passed over the race grounds, where the younger Anakin had often raced in his pods, but he barely glanced at it as he put the ship out straight over the desert, heading for Mos Eisley. When that port came into view, he veered to the north and crossed past it, moving higher in the sky. They spotted one moisture farm, then another, and then the third, almost in a direct line from the city. That one, Padme said. Anakin nodded grimly and brought the ship down on a bluff overlooking the homestead. I'm really going to see her again, he breathed, shutting down the engines. Padme squeezed his arm and offered him a comforting smile. You don't know what it's like to leave your mother like that, he said. I leave my family all the time, she replied. But you're right. It's not the same. I can't imagine what it's like to be a slave, Anakin. It's worse to know that your mother is one. Padme nodded, conceding the point. Stay with the ship, R2, she instructed the droid, who beeped in reply. The first form that came into view as they walked toward the homestead was that of a very thin droid, dull gray in color, with weather-beaten metal coverings, covering. Obviously in need of a good oil bath, he bent stiffly and worked on some sort of fence sensor. Then he rose with a jerky motion, seeing their approach.
Oh, hello, he greeted. How might I be of service? I am C-3PO?
Anakin said breathlessly, hardly believing his eyes.
Oh, my,
the droid exclaimed, and he began to shake violently.
Oh, my maker, Master Anakin, I knew you would return, I knew you would. And this must be Miss Padme.
Hello, 3PO, Padme said.
Oh, my circuits. I'm so pleased to see you both.
I've come to see my mother, Anakin explained. The droid turned sharply up toward him, then seemed to shrink back.
I think...
C-3PO stuttered.
Perhaps we'd better go indoors.
He turned toward the homestead, motioning with his hand for the couple to follow. Anakin and Padme exchanged nervous glances. Anakin could not shake the feeling of doom that lingered long after the imagery of his nightmares had faded. By the time they caught up to the droid, he was in the courtyard shouting,
Master Cleeg! Master Owen! Might I present two important visitors?
A young man and woman came rushing out of the house, almost immediately, but slowed at the sight of Padme and Anakin. "I'm Anakin Skywalker," Anakin said at once.
"Anakin?" the man echoed, his eyes going wide. "Anakin!"
The woman at his side brought her hand up to cover her mouth.
"Anakin the Jedi,"
she whispered breathlessly.
"You know of me? Shmi Skywalker is my mother."
"Mine too," said the man. "Not my real mom," he added, at Anakin's obviously puzzled look.
"But as real a mom as I've ever known."
He extended his hand. "Owen Lars, this is my girlfriend, Beru Whiteson." Beru nodded and said,
"Hello."
Padme, after giving up on Anakin, ever remembering to introduce her, came forward.
"I'm Padme."
"I guess I'm your stepbrother," Owen said, his eyes never leaving the young Jedi of whom he had heard so very much.
"I had a feeling you might show up."
"Is my mother here?"
"No, she's not,"
came a gruff answer from behind Owen and Beru, from the shadows of the house door. All four turned to see a heavyset man glide out on a hover chair. One of his legs was heavily bandaged, the other missing, and Anakin knew at once that these were fairly recent wounds. His heart seemed to leap into his throat.
"Kleek Lars," the man said, moving in close and extending his hand. "Shmi is my wife. We should go inside. We have a lot to talk about."
Anakin followed as if in a dream, a very horrible dream.
"It was just before the dawn," Kleeg was saying,
gliding toward the table in the homestead kitchen with Owen beside him, while Beru peeled off to gather some food and drinks for the guests. "They came out of nowhere," Owen added.
"A band of Tusken raiders," Kleeg explained.
A sinking feeling nearly buckled Anakin's knees, and he slumped into a seat across from Owen. He'd had some experience with Tusken raiders, but on a very limited basis. Once he had tended the wound of one gravely injured raider, and when the Tusken's friends showed up, they had let him go. Something unheard of among the more civilized species of Tatooine. But still, despite that one anomaly, Anakin didn't like hearing the name of Shmi spoken in the same breath as the grim words, "Tusken Raiders."
"Your mother had gone out early, like she always did, to pick mushrooms that grow on the vaporators," Kleeg explained. "From the tracks, she was about halfway home when they took her. Those Tuskens walk like men, but they're vicious, mindless monsters."
"We'd seen many signs that they were about," Owen piped in. "She shouldn't have gone out."
"We can't live huddled in fear," Kleeg scolded.
But he calmed at once and turned back to Anakin.
"All signs were that we'd chase the Tuskens away. We didn't know how strong this raiding band was. Stronger than anything any of us have ever seen. 30 of us went out after Shmi. 4 of us came back."
He grimaced and rubbed his leg, and Anakin felt the man's pain clearly.
"I'd still be out there, only after I lost my leg."
Kleeg nearly broke down, and it struck Anakin how much the man loved Shmi.
"I just can't ride anymore," Kleeg went on, "until I heal."
The proud man drew in a deep breath and forcibly steadied himself, squaring his broad shoulders.
"This isn't the way I wanted to meet you, son," he said. "This isn't how your mother and I planned it. I don't want to give up on her, but she's been gone a month. There's little hope she's lasted this long."
The words hit Anakin like a stinging slap, and he retreated from them, back into himself, back into the Force. He reached out, using his bond with his mother to try to somehow feel her presence in the Force. Then he shot to his feet.
"Where are you going?" Owen asked.
"To find my mother," came the grim reply.
"No, Anakin," Padme cried out, rising to grab his forearm.
"Your mother's dead, son," the resigned Kleeg added. "Accept it. Accept."
Anakin glowered at him, at them all.
"I can feel her pain," he said, his jaw clenched, teeth gritted. continuing pain, and I will find her. A moment of silence ensued, and then Owen offered, "Take my speeder bike." He jumped up from his seat and strode by Anakin. "I know she's alive," Anakin said, turning to face Padme. "I know it." Padme winced but said nothing, and she let go of Anakin's arm as he moved to follow Owen.
"I wish she'd have come a bit earlier," Kleeg lamented.
Padme looked over at him and at Beru, who was standing over the tearful man hugging him. Then, having no words to offer, Padme turned and rushed out to join Anakin and Owen. By the time she caught up, Owen was heading back for the house, and Anakin was standing near the speeder, staring out over the empty desert.
"You're going to have to stay here," Anakin said to her as she hurried to his side. "These are good people. You'll be safe."
"Anakin,
I know she's alive," he said, still staring out to the dunes.
Padme hugged him tightly.
"Find her," she whispered.
"I won't be long," he promised. And he straddled the speeder bike, kicked it to life, and rocketed away across the dunes.
Chapter 18. When the call beamed into the Jedi Temple on Coruscant, using Scramble Code 5 and in care of the Old Folks Home, Mace Windu and Yoda knew that it was important. Extremely important. They took the call in Yoda's apartment after Mace checked the corridor both ways, then pointedly closed the door. The hologram of Obi-Wan Kenobi appeared before them. The man was obviously on edge, glancing repeatedly over his shoulder.
"Masters, I have successfully made contact with Lama Su, the Prime Minister of Kamino."
"Ah, good it is that your planet you have found," Yoda said.
"Right where your students predicted," Obi-Wan replied. "These Kaminoans are cloners, best in the galaxy, I've been told. And from what I've seen, I don't doubt the claims."
Both Jedi Masters frowned. "They're using a bounty hunter named Jango Fett to create a clone army."
"An army?" Mace repeated.
"For the Republic," came Obi-Wan's startling answer. "What's more, I have a strong feeling that this bounty hunter is behind the plot to assassinate Senator Amidala."
"Do you think these cloners are involved in that as well?"
"No, Master. There appears to be no motive."
"Do not assume anything, Obi-Wan,"
Yoda advised.
"Clear your mind must be if you are to discover the real villain behind this plot."
"Yes, Master," Obi-Wan said. "Prime Minister Lama Su has informed me that the 1st Battalion of Clone Troopers are ready for delivery. He also wanted me to remind you that if we require more, and they've another million well on the way to completion, it will take more time to grow them."
"A million clone warriors?" Mace Windu asked in disbelief.
"Yes, Master. They say Master Sifo Dyas placed the order for the clone army at the request of the Senate almost 10 years ago. I was under the impression that he was killed before that. Did the Council ever authorize the creation of a clone army?"
"No," Mace answered, without hesitation, and without even looking to Yoda for confirmation.
"Whoever placed that order did not have the authorization of the Jedi Council."
"Then how? And why?"
"The mystery deepens," May said, "and it is one that needs unraveling. For more reasons than the safety of Senator Amidala."
"The clones are impressive, Master," Obi-Wan explained. "They have been created and trained for one purpose alone."
"Into custody, take this Jango Fett,"
Yoda instructed.
"Bring him here. Question him, we will."
"Yes, Master. I will report back when I have him."
Obi-Wan glanced over his shoulder again and abruptly instructed R4 to cut the transmission.
"A clone army," Mace remarked, alone with Yoda once again, the hologram gone. "Why would Sifo Dyas..."
"When placed, this order was, may provide insight,"
Yoda said, and Mace nodded. "If the timing of the order was correct, then Sifo Dyas must have placed it right before he had died."
"If this Jango Fett
was involved in trying to kill the senator, and just happened to be chosen as the source for a clone army created for the Republic. Mace Windu stopped and shook his head. The coincidence was too great for those two items to be simple chance. But how could one tie in with the other? Was it possible that whoever decided to create the clone army was afraid that Senator Amidala would be a strong enough voice to prevent that army from being used? The Jedi Master rubbed a hand over his forehead and looked to Yoda, who sat with his eyes closed, probably contemplating the same riddles as he was, Mace knew, and equally troubled, if not more so, more.
Blind we are, if the development of this clone army we could not see,
Yoda remarked.
I think it is time to inform the Senate that our ability to use the Force has diminished.
Only the Dark Lords of the Sith know of our weakness,
Yoda replied.
If informed, the Senate is, multiply our adversaries' will.
For the two Jedi Masters, this surprising development was troubling on several different levels.
Obi-Wan moved along the corridor carefully. He knew nothing of Jango Fett's accomplishments, but he figured they must be considerable, given the selection of the man as the prototype for a clone army. Pausing, he closed his eyes and reached out to the Force, searching for hidden enemies. A moment later, convinced that Jango wasn't in the immediate area, he approached the door. Gently, he ran his fingers along the frame, sensing for potential traps, then finally touched the locking mechanism. Holding one hand there, he tried the door. It didn't budge. Obi-Wan reached for his lightsaber, thinking to shear through the portal, but he changed his mind, preferring subtlety. He closed his eyes and sent his strength through his outstretched hand and into the lock, manipulating the mechanism easily. Then, one hand going to his lightsaber, he tried the door again, and it slid open. As soon as he viewed the room inside, he knew that he wouldn't be needing his weapon. The apartment was in complete disorder. The drawers of every cabinet hung open, some lay on the floor, and the chairs were knocked all askew. To the side, the bedroom door was open, and it too was a wreck. All the signs within pointed to a hurried departure. Obi-Wan glanced all about, looking for some clue, and his gaze finally settled on a thin computer screen set on a counter in the main living area. Rushing to it, he turned it on and recognized it at once as a security network, tied into various cams set about the immediate area. Obi-Wan scrolled from view to view, noting the corridor he had just traversed and various angles of the apartment itself. An outside view of the area showed the apartment's rain-lashed roof, and he could see himself through the transparent steel window. He continued his scroll, widening the lens and zooming in on anything suspicious. Then he got a shot of a nearby landing pad and an odd-looking ship with a wide flat base, narrowed to a point on the closest end and thinning as it climbed to a small compartment, perhaps large enough for two or three men. Rushing about the parked craft was a familiar figure, either Boba Fett or another clone. Obi-Wan nodded and smiled knowingly as he followed the boy's movements, recognizing from the fluidity and randomness of some small actions that this was indeed Boba and not a perfectly controlled and conditioned clone. Obi-Wan's grin didn't hold, though, as another familiar figure came into view. It was Jango, dressed in the armor and rocket pack the Jedi had seen before, on the streets of Coruscant. If Obi-Wan had had any doubts that Jango was the man who had hired Zam Wessel, those doubts were now gone. He bolted from the apartment and ran down the corridor, looking for a way out.